Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am today's host, Alexandra Kövess, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. The sustainability transition ecological economists urge would mean that we radically transform our economies and societies. Such a transformation is not without disruptions, and therefore we need tools to make it just. Our guest today, Vincent Ligy, argues that the unconditional autonomy allowance, in which all citizens are provided with guarantees to a minimum sustenance without any conditionality, is just the tool we need in degrowth transitions. It not only mitigates the insecurities around the changes and starts the redistribution much needed for a just and sustainable world, but also helps decolonizing our imaginaries. Vincent is an engineer, interdisciplinary researcher, a well-known activist for establishing a degrowth future. He has written a number of books on degrowth, among others, Exploring Degrowth, A Critical Guide with Anitra Nelson in 2020. He also coordinates the Degrowth Research and Experimentation Cooperative, Cargonomia, in Budapest. Welcome, Vincent.
Hello, Sandra. Hello, everybody.
You normally talk about unconditional autonomy allowance rather than the more well-known universal basic income. Can you help us first establish what these terms are and then explain why you believe that merely a monetary transfer would not lead to a degrowth future?
Yes, it can be long, but I will try to make it short because it's covering a lot of things. So the idea emerged in the late 2000s, the French degrowth movement, when we started to participate in election and we started to co-construct together a political program. And of course, very soon, we agreed that unconditional basic income could be an interesting tool. It could be an interesting tool to fight against rising inequalities, not to abandon anybody in a time when we were facing the 2008 economic crisis. But we also realized that it's not enough, and it has to be connected with other ideas which were also emerging inside the degrowth movements, like unconditional basic services, like the extension of gratuity or free access for a lot of common things and a lot of services and so on. And also to be connected maybe with the emergence of a lot of local initiatives, in particular alternative economic system, like local currencies or time bank and so on. So we agreed that we need a type of tool which is providing for all, unconditionally, from birth to death, what is enough to have a decent life. And we also agreed that as degrowth is first about decolonizing our imaginary and to re-embed the economy, that this tool should be a tool to implement, should be an opportunity to implement type of public deliberation and reappropriation of democracy to question what are these basic needs and how to fulfill them. And that's why we very soon invented this, and sorry for the jargon, this idea of unconditional autonomy allowance, which is following the same type of principle that unconditional basic income. So it's providing for all unconditionally, so not conditioned to any work, for example, the minimum to have a decent life. But it's not necessarily given in money, in international, supranational, or national currency, but it can be given with through a lot of different type of things, in particular, universal basic services or gratuity. And what we liked very much in that, it's really like it moves out of economy. The problem is that with unconditional basic income, it can be very compatible with capitalism. It can be implemented, and we can come back in the conversation later. It can be implemented for a lot of different type of political agenda. It can maybe help a degrowth political agenda, but not necessary. That's why we needed to have something much more complex and questioning a lot of things.
So basically, you're saying that throwing money at the problem is not necessarily going to solve the systemic problems of capitalism. So we need something else. And you're saying unconditional autonomy allowance is the way forward. But what about universal basic services? Does it resemble to that concept? Because I think most of our listeners would have heard of universal basic income and maybe universal basic services. But how is the difference between what you're saying and the universal basic services?
Yeah, indeed, unconditional autonomy allowance is embedding also universal basic services. And to be honest, when we started to have this debate in France, the concept of universal basic services, and it's also very difficult to translate it in French, didn't really exist in France. We were more speaking about, and sorry for the jargon and the difficult translation, extension of the sphere of gratuity. How to make the other type of what capitalism is doing. So how to decommodify what we consider too much important for well-being, for our dignity, to put it out of the logic of market economy. So we started to much more work on gratuity, which could embed a lot of things which could be like basic services, like health, like education, public transport, for example. But also, we put in the picture a lot of commons, a lot of goods, like maybe square meters to have a decent accommodation, square meters to make urban gardening or permaculture, square meters to have spaces to reappropriate conviviality or democracy. It's also embedded this logic of gratuity, the question of energy. So you get for free a certain amount of kilowatt hour, and you get for free also some basic goods like water. You get for free a certain number of liters and so on. And also, this idea of gratuity was connected with the idea of limits. Like, for example, we provide for all a certain number of liters of water unconditionally. And we question through deliberation first, what do we consider as a proper usage of water? How much liter makes sense to wash yourself, to cook, to drink, etc. But above a certain level, we consider that it's a misusage. Like to use water to wash your SUV or to water a golf or to fill a private swimming pool, you have a type of pricing which is increasing exponentially. So the more you would use above a certain level, the more you will pay. And we have everything embedded together. Also, when we started to speak about unconditional basic services, not talking in that way, like just to take quickly two example, health or education, very, very clearly for us, it was an opportunity to open public deliberation of what is good health. To provide free public service in a sick society like ours, with a way of life which is producing a lot of disease through stress, through junk food, through air pollution, just to take a few examples, and to let this free access for health in the hands of the pharmaceutical lobbies to sell us always more and more products and make more and more profits without questioning what is healthy society, what is good life from a degrowth perspective, wouldn't make sense. So for us to provide this basic service for free for all is an opportunity to question our way of life, to question this service, to question how do we organize it and so on. And the same for education. What is education? What is a proper education? Is it what we have right now, a type of universities with in the boards of the universities, the head of large corporation, and we don't make a space for people to develop their critics, to develop their autonomy, but on the contrary, we condition the people to be effective for the market, doesn't really make sense to provide that for free. So the question is not only, and that's what you will find all along the unconditional autonomy allowance, on the contrary to an unconditional basic income or unconditional basic services, where it's embedded in it, but the most important is how do you implement this deliberation, this reflection, these radical critics to the type of service that we are right now, and the point is not to make them for free for all as it is right now, but it's how do we collectively, democratically re-question them, reappropriate them, and reorganize them. And in the unconditional autonomy allowance, you may have remarked that there is a word autonomy since the beginning, and I think autonomy is one of the strongest degrowth philosophical pillars. So it refers to Cornelius Castoriadis, a Greek-French philosopher work. It's really how to recreate autonomy in the society, how to provide to all citizens the capacity, the capabilities, the power to have dignity unconditionally, but also to be an actor of the democracy, to really reappropriate democracy. So behind this idea, there is the idea of empowerment, this idea of emancipation and participation and reappropriation of this question. And what are our basic needs and reappropriation of the capacity to fulfill individually, collectively, and politically this dignified life?
Let's have a look at the claims that, or the debates there are around UBI and UBS, and let's see how they relate to the unconditional autonomy allowance idea. I've been thinking of a number of different claims or debates that have been ongoing. For example, that UBI helps fighting poverty, it boosts the economy, it helps the sustainability transition. In terms of services, it can shift the economy from private luxury to and public sufficiency towards more private sufficiency and public luxury. And of course, it often, the whole idea of UBI often comes up when we're talking about technology, and some people claim that it is the only way in the age when artificial intelligence will take over all our jobs. So what I'd like to ask you is let's have a look at these claims one by one and see their relevance to UAA and especially their relevance to degrowth. So the first one is the fact that it helps fighting poverty. And I think UBI is a misconcept to fight poverty, because when you're throwing money into the same economic system where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, it's only a question of regeneration. You're regenerating exactly the same mechanisms. However, I quite like your universal autonomy allowance from the point of view of Amartya Sen's capability approach, that we're basically deliberating in society what we want people to have and be able to do, and then try and provide that to all members of the community, no matter what, and basically unconditionally. So what do you think? How does it help fight poverty, and why is it different from UBI?
So yeah, first, you're definitely right. I mean, you're a better economist than I am, about the fact that there is a big danger of implementing just unconditional basic income, so to provide money for all unconditionally, which may be a good idea to finance against poverty, but quite likely it will be followed by a type of inflation. And the more money people will get, will just move the price market higher, and their difficulties will still be the same. It reminds me for what's happened in the United States after the crisis in 2008 with real estate. So we provided money to the people who were unable to reimburse their loans. And just the day after this money was provided to these people, the real estate market increased. So rents increased, the rates of their loans increased, and so on. And that money, what was distributed, ended up in the pocket of the same people of the oligarchy. So it may be the same danger. And that's why I think unconditional basic income alone is not enough to make sense, is not enough to be a political a tool which is strong enough from a degrowth perspective. That's why, for example, with the unconditional autonomy allowance, we also connected immediately these ideas with the idea of a maximum income. So you need to provide for all a minimum under which the society say we don't abandon anybody. So we maintain everybody above a level of dignity. But we also, in the same time, implement a sailing limit above which we say that we don't go further. So it's really embedded in the logic of redistribution. And then you protect already this idea of unconditional basic income, of a high risk of big inflation and high risk of reinforcing inequalities, or just to provide money for the people to be able to get more debt, to consume useless things, and to make a growth model to work for. And that's the problem with unconditional basic income. It's been defended historically by the neoliberals or ultra-liberals. It's been defended by Keynesians. It's been defended for a lot of different type of political agenda. And that's why it has to be embedded in a much wider thought. So not only maximum income is necessary to accompany such unconditional autonomy allowance or basic income, but you should also have a strong debate about how to re-embed the economy. To say it in other words, how to democratically reappropriate an economic system which is out of control of democracy. We can see how our bank system has been totally financialized, how it's totally disconnected to real economy. So to implement unconditional basic income in an economic system when you already have too much cash flying away won't help much. It will only reinforce these speculative bubbles. It will only reinforce these wrong dynamics that economics is totally disconnected to the reality. Also, to go to this debate is important to re-question what is money. What is money creation? Who is doing it? What is a central bank? What is its role? What kind of governance do you have behind? What kind of democratic deliberation do you have behind the policy to implement it? And I would say to implement, technically, it's very easy to implement unconditional basic income. It could be a good idea, but if you don't have a democratic control on the central bank, money creation, and what kind of policy you have behind, you can end up with something which is only counterproductive towards the goals of fighting against inequalities. I can keep on continue with example like that. And what is also, and to finish quickly, interesting about unconditional autonomy allowance, and it refers to the last book of my co-author in English, Anitra Nelson, it also questions the idea of beyond money. And maybe from a degrowth perspective, it's not only about reappropriating central bank money creation, go to zero interest rate type of money creation and so on, which may be interesting because if you have interest, you are pushed to always make more money on the money you produce and you are pushed to fall into the trap of growth for growth. But maybe we have to question how money is perverting our perception, is perverting our human interaction and so on. And behind this idea, you will find Karl Polanyi and the idea of re-embed the economy. But you will find also the idea on how to reappropriate economy and experiment other type or decommodify as much as possible our exchange, our solidarities. And in the unconditional autonomy allowance through alternative economic systems, through reciprocity, through gift economies, through gratuity, you move out quite substantively. You move out of the centrality of the market. You move out of the centrality of money, where money is not able to feed you. Money is not able to heat your flat and so on. You need energy and food for that. And you go back to the basics of economy. You go back to autonomy around economy, where you really question what are our basic needs. And our basic needs is not money, which is a social contract. Our basic needs are really like food, safe place to live, solidarity, education, know-hows, conviviality, care, and all these type of things. So the idea is really to decolonize the economic imaginary and to have this much more complex, in-depth deliberation about what is good life.
You've already covered why some mainstream economists are also quite embracing about UBI for the simple reason that they claim that it can boost the economy and this is good. But what's more important to us is how we can kind of help the sustainability transitions. And when I face these kind of questions, I normally say that basically the disruption that should happen in order to transit to another kind of economy is going to impact a lot of people. And unconditional autonomy allowance is something that can build a safety net for these kind of changes. And it doesn't just build a safety net, but it can also influence habits through the allowance system, like what you're included in the allowance system. And it can kind of start the debate, as you said, about how redistribution should happen in the world. What else would you say, or how else do you think it can impact these sustainability transitions if you look at it from this transitional point of view?
It's really embedded in the logic of autonomy and direct democracy, and to reappropriate all these debates that you put on the table. And what is very highly interesting, the way it's been designed and thought, is that it can be totally decentralized and relocalized. You don't have to start with the whole package. You can start step by step, sector by sector. Like, for example, in your city, you start to implement a debate about the food supply chain of your city. And you say that everybody should be able to get decent food, so organic, local, seasonal, which is environmentally friendly, regenerative for the soil and the biodiversity and so on. And we should provide that for all. So you would initiate the debate. Also, in the discussion, not to give for free this access unconditionally, but how do you self-organize yourself to implement this transition? Also, it's an opportunity through this deliberation to make the people reflect that if we keep on eating always more beef, it won't work because it has such an environmental, energetic, or water supply impact that it will simply won't be able to happen. So you create type of solidarities, type of reflection, type of empowerment about all these questions with the people that together you reach a level when you co-create the capacity to get it unconditionally for all through changing the habits and through a reorganization on the way you will produce it and maybe to share as well the hard task around that. And it can be the same on each topic you may find in it. And that's why it's highly important to always connect what is unconditional to have a decent life with the limits. Because without questioning the limits toward each dimension of these allowance, actually you don't question the redistribution. And I think it's really in the heart of degrowth, the end of growth what we are already facing and which may accelerate even more. It's pushing us to go back to the question on how to share better. And the allowance is really about that. And for each item you will consider as very important for dignity, you would also engage into the conversation about sufficiency, about how to redesign. Let's take the example of a washing machine. Let's consider that, yeah, we agree through deliberation that to have an access to washing machine to wash your clothes and so on should be unconditional for all. And then you can engage into the conversation on how to achieve that in a sustainable way. Quite likely not following the trends of the market right now to have a planned obsolescence type of washing machine, which are not repairable, which are individual and so on. And you may move and it can take different type of dimension depending on where you are, the culture, the habits, the people you are opening this conversation with. You may move that let's share one washing machine in a room in our group of accommodations, in our building, in our district, and so on. Let's design the washing machine differently, that it could be repairable. It's not based on planned obsolescence, but differently. Let's understand what kind of energy a washing machine is using. So actually, washing machine, most of the energy used is to heat the water. So let's find a solution to heat the water in a more sustainable way, maybe to implement solar thermal panels. And as you do it together, you can share the knowledge, and you can also self-implement that and share the investment in the knowledge, in the know-hows, in the materials, in the implementation to achieve the sustainability. And you end up with something which is transforming the society, transforming the way you fulfill the basic need, transforming your relationship with work, transforming your relationship with the know-hows, the tools, and so on. That's why we speak about autonomy. And back to unconditional basic income, when we started to put unconditional basic income in the debate in the French degrowth movement in the late 2000s, what was for us the most interesting dimension of what was the most attractive, what could unconditional basic income bring, was the idea that you can quit your bushy job. In a society where everybody gets unconditional basic income, everybody has the capacity, the capability to say, no, I refuse to work anymore for advertisement company where I know that I manipulate the brain of the people to make them desire things that we don't need. I refuse to work anymore for these, for the military industrial complex and so on. And for us, as a first step, we thought it's an interesting tool because you reappropriate time, you reappropriate capacity, energy, know-hows, knowledge, what we can share in the society to reappropriate how we redesign our society. And it fits in the picture on the step toward unconditional autonomy at once. And it's quite interesting that nowadays when we speak about unconditional basic income, we forgot about this dimension to decouple the need to have a bullshit job, where most of the time nowadays, you need to accept that job to be able to survive, to reimburse your loan and so on. And the statistics about dissatisfaction, about stress, about precarity, bad working condition and so on in the work area are terrible. And we can see that we need a tool to liberate these people from this imposed employment, to move to a society organized around self-organized and emancipatory activities. And I think it's in the heart of degrowth and it's in the heart of this idea of unconditional autonomy at once, taking this power of unconditional basic income on board and articulating it with other ideas like unconditional basic services, gratuity, local economic system, gift economy, etc., etc., care economy, etc., etc.
Once you're on the topic of work, can we bring in the connection to technology and how UAA is dealing with the idea of technological change? And of course, there are different perspectives. There's like a huge debate around UBI in the mainstream media, and it's almost always something to do with artificial intelligence and technological change. And the perspectives are obviously manifold. One is a kind of justice perspective where we say, well, all technological development belongs to the human race overall and not just a few people who are now in the winner-takes-it-all markets and they are currently winners. And of course, the other one is that people will be unemployed due to technology and this is the only way to keep the peace and, of course, keep the wealth by the chosen few. So what's the relationship of UAA to this whole idea of technological change and what is the narrative around that?
Yeah, it's a good example where we can see that just an economic tool, like any kind of tool, can be used for interesting or meaningful or emancipatory purposes, or just for very toxic ones. And as I said before, a conditional basic income is something which is interesting to go toward unconditional autonomy at once in the degrowth project. But it's also something which is highly powerful for the oligarchy and the dominant system to keep on going. Behind that, you have the fairy tale of this high tech, which will be able to destroy employment, and we will be served by machines and robots and artificial intelligence and an economy which will be totally dematerialized and so on. So it's a fairy tale because when you scrutinize what the material impact and input which is necessary to go to this fairy tale, it simply doesn't work. But a lot of our friends from the left believes in that fairy tale and started to be afraid with their goal to defend social justice, started to be afraid with their woke central paradigm in their mindset that it will create always more and more unemployment and how to occupy the people if there is unemployment and so on. And you can see that how this tool can also be used as something which is not helping to enlighten the debate. And again, that's why unconditional autonomy allowance from a Diego's perspective is from a philosophical or from a democratic, from a creativity point of view, much more powerful, because it pushes for the conversation to go much further. And the point is not to fight against unemployment and to fight against only the inequalities in the same absurd system what we are living on, but it's really to emancipate ourselves from this very reductionist narrow, with a huge lack of creativity, boring, morbid, stressy way of life that we are right now around employment to produce stupid things, around division of work, where also, and you can find that behind the idea of unconditional autonomy allowance, where it's also somehow connected with the care income, which is developed by a lot of other friends inside the degrowth movement. It's also the question on how we can, again, understand better and put a focus on that. What do we really need and what's really important for our well-being? And if you stay in the dominant economic understanding of this question, you will only think about what is commodified and through the tasks which are implemented, what is paid. So, you know, like what is paid is understood by the economists. A care economy which is not paid is not understood by economists, is put invisible and so on. And it's highly interesting because if you go into the other debate and you start to question what's really important for my well-being, you will realize that most of the activities and tasks which are the most important for a dignified life, for well-being, for enjoyment of life, are outside of the sphere of employment and paid work. They will be in care, they will be in friendship, they will be in volunteer work, they will be in all the informal solidarities which are still all around the society. And through the unconditional autonomy allowance, it's to really provide a support and provide visibility to all these important tasks, moreover, which are very often mostly made by women without being paid. So it's also behind the idea of gender equalities, of ecofeminism, and so on. So, and to move out of this very narrow understanding of work and employment, this economic understanding of the society, and so on, and to, on the contrary, provide a type of poetry and beauty of what are the meaningful tasks and how to share it to achieve for all dignity and enjoyment of life. It's what, in my sense, is the degrowth political project. And you will find that in unconditional autonomy allowance.
You tend to talk about unconditional autonomy allowance more like a package. Are there any elements in the package that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah, I already mentioned several, like maximum income. When we work first in the unconditional autonomy allowance in the late 2000s, maximum income was maybe enough to tackle rising inequalities in our society. But as we can see, you know, inequalities are more coming from the accumulating wealth and the speculation of accumulating wealth. So maximum income is maybe not necessary enough. So we have to implement a maximum income. In the book we published 10 years ago about unconditional autonomy allowance, we speak about a ratio from 1 to 4 between the minimum and the maximum. But we need to also question how to redistribute the huge accumulation of wealth by a minority, by an oligarchy. I mean, I don't go into these figures about how the richest people are contributing enormously compared to the poorer people about climate change, how the inequalities are exploding. Just look at the last Oxfam report, year after year, in the last year, it's exponentially exploding. So we should also open the debate of redistribution. We should also open the debate of inheritance, which is a tough debate because it mixes some emotional, affective dimension and type of economic rationality, or social and environmental justice dimension. Maybe the richest people, they could become so rich because some time in the history of the family, they could appropriate illegally or unfairly a huge amount of things. I mean, I don't quote Proudhon, property is a robbery, or if I translate it into English. And it goes to the debate, which is how to re-embed the economy and how to move more to a decommodifying type of economy around the commons, and how to move out of neither private nor public property, but something else. And to reinvent, I say reinvent because it's been working like that for a very long time. I mean, what we are experiencing nowadays in our Western society and mindset is a very short time of the history of the 300,000 years of Homo sapiens sapiens on this planet. So how to reinvent other type of democratic deliberative governance for the common, and how to share, use all this wealth differently in a much more fair way and, of course, sustainable way. And behind that, you will find a lot of debates and proposals around the public and private debt audits. So how to create type of what we did in France for the climate justice with the Citizen Convention for Climate. So how you can create type of deliberative convention of citizens who could scrutinize private debt, public debt, not to pay back, how to cancel the part of the debt which are unfair. If you go to private debt, very often the higher is the private debt of a company, the richer they are, because money is based on accumulation of debt and type of Ponzi pyramid and so on. And I would say how to go through this type of scrutinization through democratic processes, through type of audits, to redistribute the cards in non-violent way. May it be violent to redistribute stolen properties in a fair way? I don't know, but I would say that it's one of the key challenges of degrowth. And you will find that also in the idea of unconditional autonomy allowance, or through this first slogan of degrowth, that the first of degrowth should be a degrowth or a decrease in inequality. And without growth, it has to go through this radical question on how to question property.
Thank you so much for this conversation. But last, I would like to ask you the question we ask all our guests. What is your rebellion?
I would say my rebellion is enjoyment of life. And I have the chance here in Budapest with Cargonomia and our cooperatives, with a lot of contradictions and a lot of challenge, of course, because we are still embedded in this society. We have the opportunity to self-implement to ourselves as a core group of Cargonomia, a type of unconditional autonomy allowance, which provides a lot of enjoyment of life. And I would say that for degrowth, the most powerful tool and the best rebellion what we could put on the table is really like, let's enjoy life in liberating ourselves of this very narrow and reductionist market economy we are unfortunately embedded in, and make creativity work wonderfully to just reappropriate your free time, reappropriate the tools, reappropriate your autonomy.
I think that's a wonderful message for the end of our conversation. Many thanks to Vincent, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Bye, Vincent.
Thanks, Sandra, and thanks for this great podcast channel.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.